From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. In 1964, the United States Supreme Court issued a landmark ruling aimed at ensuring a vigorous free press in America. The case was called New York Times Company against Sullivan. It made it harder, not impossible, but harder, for public officials to sue news outlets for libel. Over the years, the court expanded that idea to other public figures, celebrities, business leaders, and even everyday people made prominent by circumstances. And the protection enabled robust coverage of everything from the civil rights movement to government corruption. For decades, this was a relatively rare area of consensus in American politics, but that is not true anymore. Here's then-candidate Donald Trump in 2016 at a rally in Fort Worth, Texas.
One of the things I'm going to do, if I win, and I hope I do, and we're certainly leading, is I'm going to open up our libel laws so when they write purposely negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money. We're going to open up those libel laws so that when the New York Times writes a hit piece, which is a total disgrace, or when the Washington Post, which is there for other reasons, writes a hit piece, we can sue them and win money instead of having no chance of winning because they're totally protected.
And it's not just Trump who's behind this. There's a concerted campaign among people on the right wing of American politics to overturn the Sullivan precedent, and in so doing, weaken the American press. All this is the subject of a new book by my first guest today. David Enrich is business investigations editor at the New York Times, but more to the point for our conversation, he's the author of the new book, Murder the Truth, Fear the First Amendment, and a Secret Campaign to Protect the Powerful. This is a conversation that we first aired in April, so no live calls today, but let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. All right, David, let's start. Broadly speaking, how does libel law work in the United States under the Sullivan precedent?
Well, for normal people who are not public officials or public figures, it's very simple. If you are libeled, so if someone writes or says something that is false and damages your reputation, you can win a lawsuit against them as long as you prove that they were negligent, which is a pretty low bar to cross. The bar goes up if you are a public figure or a public official. And for people like that, there's what's known as the actual malice standard. And that's from the Supreme Court precedent in 1964 that you mentioned. And it basically says that if you're a public figure or public official, in order to win, you need to prove not only that your reputation was damaged by something that was false, you need to also prove that whoever said or wrote that falsehood did so knowing that what they were writing was false. So in other words, they were lying, or they did so with reckless disregard for the truth. And the Supreme Court created this high bar for a reason, which you alluded to earlier, but I'll just restate for because it's really important, which is that in a democracy where we value free speech and where the media is supposed to serve as a check on the power of the government and on the power of other influential people in society, it's really important that they have breathing room so that if they get a fact wrong by mistake or make some other sort of honest error, they are not going to get sued into oblivion, because otherwise people will basically start to self-censor themselves. And that is exactly what the Supreme Court saw happening in the 1960s amid the civil rights movement. And they really wanted to kind of guard against that happening.
One of the things I appreciate about the book is that you do, you know, have that storytelling in there. It's not just a, you know, sort of a dry policy tome. Maybe take us back to the actual example of the Sullivan case and what was happening that in that incident. I mean, there's so many colorful characters from the local trial judge to everything else.
Yeah. So, and the case originated when the New York Times ran a full page ad in 1960, and it was paid for by supporters of Martin Luther King. And it was basically a fundraising appeal. And the ad, there's a lot of text in the ad. And it was this kind of description of a litany of abuses by racist Southern officials who were trying to preserve white supremacy. And the gist of the ad was completely true. And a lot of Southern officials were using violent and kind of Stalinist methods to suppress the civil rights movement. but there were some details in the ad that were either wrong or were exaggerated. And one of the things that was exaggerated was the description of the Montgomery, Alabama police force, which was a violent and racist police force, but some of the particular facts were either exaggerated or wrong. And so one of the people who saw the ad was a guy named L.B. Sullivan, who was essentially in charge of the Montgomery police force at the time. And so he filed a lawsuit against the New York Times claiming that his reputation had been damaged, even though he wasn't actually even named in the ad. But he claimed that he had been defamed and his reputation had been harmed, and filed this lawsuit. And the case went to trial in the Montgomery courtroom of an avowed white supremacist who also happened to be a pedophile, as if the white supremacy wasn't bad enough. And the jury consisted of, it was all white, and it consisted of people who were showing up to court wearing Confederate battle uniforms or costumes, and in some cases carrying pistols. And so you will not be surprised to hear that the jury very quickly ruled in favor of L.B. Sullivan and against the New York Times. And it was a $500,000 in damages that were awarded, which maybe doesn't sound like a huge amount these days, but in the early 1960s, that was a really considerable amount. And it was such a considerable amount, in fact, that the Times decided that to avoid the possibility of other lawsuits by people like Sullivan, that they were going to pull their reporters out of Alabama and basically stop writing about things like institutional racism in the South. And that was the exact consequence that L.B. Sullivan was looking for. And he and some of his peers had taken to filing these types of lawsuits against national news outlets, whether it was the Times or like CBS or ABC. And their intent was quite explicit, which was that they wanted to make it financially dangerous for these outlets to cover the civil rights movement aggressively. And what the Supreme Court was reacting to in the Sullivan decision a couple of years later was that that strategy was proving really effective, and it was becoming financially dangerous, if not impossible, for these national news outlets to write about what was happening in the South.
A $5.3 million judgment today. One of our producers ran the numbers on that. So the court decides that you have to have these standards you talked about earlier, actual malice. Talk about American exceptionalism in this regard, because there are not a lot of countries, or at least a lot of other countries, don't give this robust level of protection against lawsuits.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And look, I'm biased. I've been a journalist my entire adult life. But I mean, to me, this is one of the things that makes America great. Like, we have a First Amendment that simply does not exist in many other Western democracies, even. And you have countries like England that is much, much easier for powerful people to file and win lawsuits against news outlets. And the result of that is that, you know, you have Russian oligarchs or big companies rushing to London to file lawsuits against American journalists sometimes.
And it's libel tourism, really, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's called libel tourism. And that has, over the years, created a real chilling effect on doing really good, strong accountability journalism in the UK, which is not at all to say it doesn't happen, but you run a much higher risk in doing so. And lawyers there have been kind of conditioned over the years to really make it much, they really discourage, in some cases, journalists from pursuing or publishing pieces like this. And that is one of, and that's true in a lot of other countries as well. And one of the things that has made America special in this regard is not simply the existence of the First Amendment, although that does not exist in other countries, but it's the way the Supreme Court has interpreted the First Amendment over the years. And, you know, the First Amendment is only 45 words, the words are not super specific. And so, you know, I think the consensus is, or at least has been for a long time, that the intent of the framers in writing those 45 relatively vague words was to give future generations the chance to interpret and reinterpret those words as circumstances evolved. And the way it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court up until right now has been that it is more important to give journalists and members of the public breathing room so that they can discuss, debate, criticize, investigate people who hold power in their community or in their country, even if that means that it is harder to collect damages. In fact, it's specifically because the act of collecting damages against people who are criticizing you is often intended to suppress their speech and get them to back away.
If you're just joining us, it's the 21st show. We're listening back to our recent conversation with David Enrich. He's the author of Murder the Truth, Fear, the First Amendment, and a Secret Campaign to Protect the Powerful. He's also a business investigations editor at the New York Times. We're on tape for the hour, so no live calls, but you can let us know what you thought by leaving a voicemail at 217-300-2121. One of the things that I found interesting in the book is that there was such a broad consensus. Even as so many other things were polarizing in America, there was still a consensus on this. And maybe we should actually play a piece of tape here, because there's a character who is important throughout the book, and that is Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. You have a great poll from his first round of confirmation hearings. And I should say, for listeners who may not remember, this is before the allegations of sexual harassment by Anita Hill had been made public. He'd still had what he viewed as some rough treatment in the press, and he makes a strong defense of the Sullivan precedent in these hearings.
But I think what the court was attempting to do there was, of course, to balance the First Amendment rights, the freedom of the press, as we know it, and to not have that in a way impeded by one's abilities to sue the media or to intimidate the media, and applied a standard of actual malice and struck a balance by protecting the rights of the individual with the standard of actual malice. That is something, of course, that one could debate, but I think it is demonstration, a clear demonstration on the court's part that the freedom of the press is important in our society, it's critical in our society, even though individuals may at times be hurt by the use of the of that right.
Do you see any need to change that standard?
I at this moment certainly have not thought about changing that standard and have no agenda to change that standard. I think the court is my view, as I've attempted to express here, is that we should protect our First Amendment freedoms as much as possible.
David, fast forward 30 years and talk about Justice Thomas's agenda that he does seem to have now with regard to the Sullivan precedent.
Yeah, he has come complete full circle, or maybe not full circle, half circle, 180 degrees.
180,
switch. He has become the leading advocate for overturning New York Times versus Sullivan. And he started this campaign publicly in 2019, issuing an opinion calling for its overturning in an obscure case that the Supreme Court wasn't even accepting for review. And since then, he has repeated and expanded on his argument in a number of other opinions. And in a lot of ways, Thomas, he is the one who has kind of ignited this movement in public. And it had been brewing behind the scenes for several years before Thomas kind of announced his position. But there, the evolution of his thinking on this and his ultimate reversal in his thinking over that, you know, 25 or 30 year period, I think it's very emblematic of a broader shift that's happened, in particular on the right wing, where people have gone from recognizing that the First Amendment protects everyone. It does not matter if you agree or disagree with their viewpoint. It does not matter if they're liberal or conservative. It doesn't matter if you're a journalist or an activist or just a member of a community that wants to have a voice on a matter of importance in your town. It protects everyone. And there had been a very strong bipartisan consensus, not just like with moderate Republicans either. And Jeff Sessions, as recently as 2010, co-sponsored legislation that passed where he was pushing to kind of enshrine Sullivan in American law. And he and his closest aide, a guy named Stephen Miller, who is now one of President Trump's closest aides, were championing that. And so there's been this very rapid reversal that I think speaks to, and part of it, it speaks to a bunch of different things. One of them is that there's been this rapid erosion in trust in the media. But I think a bigger part of it, a much bigger part, is that many people on the right have come to view the media, in particular the mainstream media, as a not just a nuisance, but an impediment to pushing an agenda that often relies on falsehoods and lies and distortions and conspiracy theories. And when you have a credible, independent, vigorous, fearless media refuting those lies and distortions, that poses potentially a really big impediment to your agenda. And so I think that to me, that is the biggest explanation of the shift that we've seen, not just with Thomas, but with conservatives of all stripes over recent years.
All right, we need to take a break. Let me remind listeners first that this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to our conversation with David Enrich, who's the author of Murder the Truth, Fear of the First Amendment, and a Secret Campaign to Protect the Powerful. The book is about an effort that's been ongoing for years now to overturn the United States Supreme Court precedent of New York Times versus Sullivan, which basically raises the standards for suing news outlets or anyone really, if they're a public official, for libel. Since our conversation's on tape today, we're not taking calls live, but you can let us know what you thought by sending an email to talk@21stshow.org. Coming up a little later in the program, we'll hear about other struggles of the news media, particularly local newspapers in Illinois. A lot of them have been consolidating, others have folded altogether. Illinois has been fairly hard hit compared to a lot of other states. That's coming up later this hour here on The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to our conversation with David Enrich, author of the book Murder the Truth, Fear the First Amendment, and a Secret Campaign to Protect the Powerful. It's about a long-running effort in the right wing of American politics to overturn the special court protections that people have against libeling public figures. There's a standard that has to be proved called actual malice, and showing that a newspaper acted with reckless disregard for the truth. It basically makes it harder to sue newspapers and television stations for libel. The idea here is that because we want a robust press that can do deep investigations and tackle tough issues like the civil rights movement or government corruption, we want them to have a special level of protection from getting sued out of existence. We're on tape for the hour today, so no calls live. We first broadcast this conversation back in April, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. David, can you talk more about what you understand changed here? I mean, is this just yet another example of sort of people on the right in America taking more of a YOLO approach to our institutions since, you know, President Trump has sort of made that the more dominant vibe, if you will, on that side of the political spectrum?
Yeah. I think that's part of it. I think that there is, and Trump, obviously, from the moment he descended on that golden escalator back in 2015, has made bashing the media kind of a central part of his shtick and his campaign platform. And that's, you know, there's nothing new about that. What's new is the degree to which Trump has embraced it and kind of the lengths that he has gone to demonize journalists, sometimes by name. And that approach has obviously caught on very really just across the country, and not just with people at the national political level. It's been at the local level as well. And one of the things I saw in reporting this book was that, you know, the tactics that Trump and his allies at the national level have used against journalists, whether it's nasty rhetoric or filing lawsuits, have really trickled down across the country. And that means that there's a whole cast of lawyers and law firms now that specialize in bringing lawsuits or just making legal threats against news organizations and journalists. And this is not like the New York Times and Washington Post or NPRs of the world. This is often against small community news outlets, or in some cases, independent journalists who have like a newsletter or a podcast or a YouTube channel and are interrogating or criticizing people in their communities over things like a real estate development that maybe is going to like has environmental risks attached to it, or a local businessman who has used slurs at community meetings. And people are getting attacked through threats and litigation for accurately reporting that kind of information that to me seems very much in the public interest. And so I think to me the interesting transformation here is that this has gone, as so many other things in our country have, it's gone from being this kind of hot button and highly politicized issue at the national level to really affecting things at a much more micro level in communities across the country. And the result of it is that it is, or there's at least a really good chance that this trend, if it continues, is going to make it much harder for any sort of local news to exist, at least in a way where it's where people are trying to do accountability journalism and report about powerful people or institutions in their local areas.
You know, we should say when a news outlet does get things wrong and is unwilling to correct the record on it, like it's not impossible to win these types of cases as it is. I covered, oh gosh, almost 20 years ago now, the Illinois Supreme Court Chief Justice at the time, a man named Bob Thomas, sued a suburban Chicago newspaper for libel. It was a 3-week trial and he prevailed in the end. And frankly, I'm not going to comment on whether it was a good idea for the Chief Justice of Illinois to sue a newspaper, but I think the news outlet was in the wrong based on my understanding and having sat through the entire trial. So it's not impossible to do this. I guess that really does suggest. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. And that happens a lot. And to me, that's one of the kind of ironies here is that a lot of the critics of New York Times versus Sullivan, including Clarence Thomas, but also including some of the activists and lawyers who are trying to overturn it, is that they claim that the Sullivan precedent has created this kind of insurmountable barrier to bringing successful lawsuits. And that's, it's just not true. And there are a lot of examples recently of people lying and being held to account for those lies or for being reckless and sloppy in the reporting and being held accountable for that. And there's a case recently against CNN where a jury ruled against them for having defamed someone. There've been a lot of cases where right-wing people like Rudy Giuliani or Alex Jones or Fox News have lost or been held accountable in defamation cases. And so no one's arguing, or at least I'm not arguing, that you should not be able to sue when your reputation is damaged and because someone is lying about you or being reckless about you. That's what the law and the First Amendment currently allows. And I think that's appropriate. To me, the more troubling thing is A, that we're seeing that even with these robust legal protections and First Amendment protections, a lot of people have recognized that because many journalists and news outlets and members and just members of the public don't have a lot of money and aren't interested in spending years in protracted litigation, these threats can be and these lawsuits can be very effective at silencing speech, even when the law is on their side. And because people do not have the money or time or resources to go to court to fight this. So there is kind of an end run around the First Amendment that a lot of powerful people are now participating in. And again, that's in a world with these robust protections. And in the goal, the very explicit, clear goal of this legal movement is to weaken those protections. And I don't think it's very easy, in fact, for me to imagine if that were to be the case, that there's just a lot of misconduct, corruption, bad actions by powerful people, powerful companies, powerful organizations all over the country that will just go. People will not report about it and it will remain hidden because the costs of speaking up about it are just really too high.
David Enrich is the author of the book Murder the Truth, Fear the First Amendment, and a Secret Campaign to Protect the Powerful. He's also an editor at the New York Times. David, thanks for sharing your work with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me.